what these three demands do, that are the demands of the BDS movement, is they bring back all Palestinians into the struggle, whereas the peace process, so-called peace process, excluded most Palestinians from the struggle and excluded them from the past, the present, and the future.
Ali Abu Nima is a Palestinian author and co-founder of the Electronic Intifada. He is a frequent speaker and commentator on the Middle East, contributing regularly to the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times, among other publications. This speech, entitled Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions, How They Fit in a Strategy for Freedom, Equality, and Return, was given at the 8th Annual Al-Auda International Convention in May 2010.
I just came back from South Africa a few days ago. This morning I really had to remind myself where I was. And then when I saw the palm trees, I remembered this must be California. There were so many inspiring things, sobering things, but inspiring things in South Africa. It's really a free country. It's not a utopia. Anyone who told you that ending apartheid would bring utopia was certainly not telling you the truth. But it's a very inspiring example of what happens when people struggle for their liberation. And there's so much more work to do. The poverty and inequality there are not the result of ending apartheid and creating a democratic state. They're the legacy of centuries of colonialism and apartheid that still need to be addressed and struggled for. One of the things I saw in South Africa that really stuck with me was the Apartheid Museum in Johannesburg. And I should have thought to bring the picture, but I have a picture of me standing in the museum next to one of the huge armored vehicles that used to go through the townships firing Israeli-made weapons at young black teenagers struggling for their rights, struggling for the right to education. And here we were posing and having photos next to this machine of terror in a museum. And I dreamed of the day when we take our children to have photos of the Israeli armored vehicles in the Museum of Zionism. When Zionism exists only in a museum dedicated to liberation from Zionism. And one of the inspiring things in that museum is you see how much the struggle against apartheid was really not just a battle against steel and guns and weaponry, but it was a battle of ideas. And it was the idea of freedom, of liberation, that triumphed over the idea of separation, of supremacy, of dominance, that ultimately defeated apartheid. And it's why I think we're going to win our struggle against Zionism and win the struggle for liberation. I'm convinced of that. I want to come back to that in a moment, but I do want to say something about the forthcoming proximity talks, or what I call the proximity show. And no, this is going to be very, very entertaining. It really is. But one of the things that I think is important is not to dismiss this completely, as meaningless as it seems, because I think there is another story going on that we need to pay attention to, and that's very dangerous. One thing is, why all the focus on negotiations? I mean, when I read the New York Times and the Washington Post and all the various accounts, it seems to me everything has already been agreed. You can read it 10 times a day. Everyone already knows what a final settlement will look like. Isn't that what they constantly tell us? That everyone knows what it will look like. Well, what will it look like? According to the many articles that have been published, the peace plans that have been leaked from Zbigniew Brzezinski, from Stephen Solarz, from various think tanks and people close to the Obama administration. It's going to be something along the lines of the so-called Clinton parameters, which looks simply like this. On the issue of settlements, all the major settlements housing most of the settlers will remain where they are. They would be annexed to Israel. The same formula has been adopted for Jerusalem. The sweet way they put it is Jewish neighborhoods, Israel would get Jewish neighborhoods, and the Palestinian state would get the Arab neighborhoods. What that translates into in reality is Israel gets to keep everything that it stole, and if they're lucky, the Palestinians will get what's left, which we know is very little. Actually, the so-called peace process creates an incentive for Israel to colonize as fast as it can, because Israel knows from the history of the peace process that the maximum ceiling of Palestinian aspirations is only whatever is left today. There's no talk and no question of actually unraveling and going back and dismantling settlements. The maximum Palestinians can hope for under the peace process is whatever is left today. So if half a cake is left today, the Palestinian, the maximum demand will be half a cake. If a quarter of the cake is left tomorrow, that will be their maximum aspiration. So this dynamic gives Israel a reason to colonize as fast as possible. On the issue of refugees, now, Deanna Bhutu said that this hasn't been mentioned. In fact, it has been discussed. With the last Israeli government headed by Ehud Olmert, there were more than 200 direct negotiating sessions between Mahmoud Abbas and Ehud Olmert and their people, more than 200 sessions. And Saeb Arafat, the self-styled chief negotiator, Kabir al-Mufawadin. It's a very important title. We shouldn't laugh. Kabir al-Mufawadin published a paper in December, which he circulated. I wrote a review of it on the Electronic Intifada. He should have gone to prison, Ziad, because his English and his language would be much, much better if he learnt it in prison instead of wherever he learnt it. In any case, what we could learn from the paper and what he told the Israeli press, what he told Haaretz in an interview, is the following. That Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas, not Ziad Abbas, Mahmoud Abbas proposed to Israel that no more than 15,000 refugees per year be allowed to return to Israel for a period of 10 years. So in other words, a total of 150,000 over 10 years, that's it. And according to Arafat, Olmert responded with an offer of 1,000 refugees per year for 5 years, or 5,000. Now, what's the difference there? The difference isn't that big. What the Palestinian Authority already conceded the rights of millions of refugees. There's now 5 million refugees registered to receive services from UNRWA. So that doesn't include the many refugees who aren't receiving services from UNRWA and the people living here in Southern California or Illinois or anywhere else. So if you just take the refugees who are receiving services from UNRWA, what they're haggling about now is the difference between 5,000 and 150,000. So they're haggling over 145,000 refugees, which is less than 3% of the refugees receiving services from UNRWA. So they already negotiated about the right of return and decided to give it up. So we should be very clear about that, that this talk of negotiations is nonsense. The negotiations already reached their conclusion. So that's very important to know. What I believe is, I mean, what they're putting on the table, this so-called peace plan, which now people like Brzezinski are pushing the Obama administration to adopt openly. They're saying, make it your plan, put forward an American plan. And I believe that the Obama administration may do that, and it's very dangerous, because this is how it's going to work. Cast your minds back 10 years ago, it's hard to believe it's already 10 years, to Camp David, where President Clinton brought Arafat and they brought this deal, which was for a Bantustan, for a Palestinian mini-state with no right of return. You know the story, this ridiculous idea. And they told Arafat, sign. And Arafat, he had gone a long way with the Americans and Israelis. He did most of what they wanted, but at this last step, he said no. And then you know what happened in the next 10 years. And the Americans said this time, they said, we will not make the same mistake. This time, we will go to the tailor, like you go for a suit, and we'll have the tailor make us Palestinian leaders who will sign. We're not going to go and buy one from the shop, and we don't know, you know, what's in it, if it's polyester or lycra or cotton or wool. We want a Palestinian leader that's 100% polyester, that won't shrink when you put it in the washing machine. And so they created Salam Fayyad, who always wears a very nice suit. And they brought the same peace plan, only less. Now what they're offering, or what they're talking about, they're not actually offering it yet, is much less than Camp David. The only thing that changed is the Palestinian leaders. Now, I think even the Americans are smart enough to know that a signature on such a peace plan will be meaningless, because none of us will buy into it. None of us here and none of us on the ground in Palestine. So this is what the Fayyad plan is about, this idea of building office space. And I keep asking, Fayyad keeps saying that they're building the institutions of the Palestinian state on the ground. I keep asking, what are the institutions they're building? Can somebody name a single institution Salam Fayyad is building? A democratic parliament? No, we know what happened to that. Free universities? No, we know that students who dissent are being arrested and carried off. A transparent economy? No, we know from the corruption and the crony capitalism and the construction now of Palestinian settlements like Rawabi that there's no economic transparency. The only thing they're building, the only institutions they're building, is so-called security forces to arrest people and prisons to put them in. These are the institutions that they're building. Nevertheless, I believe that one option they're keeping in reserve is to allow Fayyad to declare a Palestinian state, supposedly in defiance of Israel and the United States. To say, to hell with these negotiations, they're not going to go anywhere, we declare a state ourselves. So that it can be presented to the Palestinian people as an achievement. The same thing that people would say this is nonsense if it was based on an agreement would say, well, this is what we could achieve by our own means, so we should embrace it. And this is the danger, I think, of people being deceived by this. And it's very important to be clear and to be warned about the danger of this monstrosity that they want to call a Palestinian state, whether by agreement or by a self-declaration. So some of those who tell us this is the only alternative want to dismiss the fact that there is actually a real alternative to this, and it's one that is alive and well and growing. And it's one of its tools, or its main tool as far as we're concerned in this country, is BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions. But we have to understand how it fits in, how it's part of a bigger political program, and that's what I want to talk about a bit now. The BDS movement originates with the 2005 call from Palestinian civil society, from hundreds of organizations across Palestinian civil society, calling on global civil society to undertake a comprehensive academic, cultural, and economic boycotts of Israel until Israel meets three conditions. And the three conditions are stated in the Palestinian BDS call. One, ending Israel's occupation and colonization of all Arab lands and dismantling the wall in the West Bank, the apartheid wall. Two, recognizing the fundamental rights of the Arab-Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality. And three, respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties as stipulated in UN Resolution 194. Now, what you notice about these three calls or these three demands is that they address the rights of all Palestinians, not just the minority that lives in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. In fact, the minority that's indigenous to the West Bank and Gaza Strip, because there are many refugees in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And also how pragmatic they are. They're very pragmatic demands. Take them in reverse, the right of return. We're always told it's not pragmatic to demand the right of return. On the contrary, it's very pragmatic. The refugees are there and the lands are there. All you need to do is bring the two together. Most of the land from which the refugees were forced to leave, take for example Gaza, 80% of the people in Gaza are refugees. Something like 95% of their land is empty. And don't quote that exact figure, but it's a large proportion because most of them come from the areas just east and north of Gaza where there are almost no Israelis living. Their lands are empty. What's stopping their return? Only one thing. That they're the wrong kind of human being as far as Israel is concerned. If they were the correct kind of human being, if they were Jews as far as Israel was concerned, they would be welcomed back with open arms. So we can understand what Gaza is now. It's a concentration camp for the wrong kind of human being. That's it. It's very simple. And if Israel said, these people can't return because they have the wrong skin color, everyone would understand the racism behind it, the racism behind the denial of the right of return. But what's different? What's different? What's the difference? You don't get to choose your religion as far as Israel is concerned. You're born with it, and they put it on your identity card. You don't get to decide what's on it. So it functions exactly the same way a skin color or race did in South Africa or in this country. So it's very pragmatic. And there are examples, for example, in Bosnia, the Dayton Accords, not the Keith Dayton Accords, the Dayton Ohio Accords, which were signed in 1995 in this country, guaranteed the right of return for refugees in the former Yugoslavia. And in fact, in Bosnia, which has a total population of about 3.5 million people, more than 500,000 refugees returned to their original homes, to their villages, many in areas which were now controlled by a hostile majority, and they did it with full assistance from the same international community which tells the Palestinians, forget about your right of return. So we need to know and study these precedents, which are not only legal precedents, but practical ones. The second demand, full equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel. One of the things that we have often forgotten in our struggle is the struggle of Palestinians inside Israel, who are long abandoned, really, by the Palestinian national movement. And yet they maintained their resistance and their steadfastness and their demands for equality. And their demand has always been, or it has been for a long time, a state of all its citizens, that Israel be a state of all its citizens instead of a state that provides rights to one group at the expense of another. What's impractical about that? Can anyone tell me what's not pragmatic about demanding equal rights for everyone living in a state? And then finally, ending the occupation and colonization of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Actually, that's probably the hardest demand, because it does require us to deal with the reality of 500,000 settlers. And it requires us to think of decolonization as being not just about the physical removal of settlements, but the removal of settler privilege, the removal of the system and the defeat of the ideology, which says that one group of people can carry Uzi machine guns and take people's land and drive on first-class roads, while another group of people are lucky if they can live in the cracks between the settlements. So what these three demands do, that are the demands of the BDS movement, is they bring back all Palestinians into the struggle, whereas the peace process, so-called peace process, excluded most Palestinians from the struggle and excluded them from the past, the present, and the future. The tactic of BDS is one that we can all participate in, and this is where I really want to applaud and thank the students and activists at UC Berkeley. Because, you know, I want to tell you, when I was in South Africa, people were asking me, tell us what's happening at UC Berkeley. What does this mean? Does this signal the beginning of a change in the United States? And I was happy to say, yes, it does signal a change. There are people who want you to fail. And there are people who claim to be pro-Palestinian who want you to fail. But the important thing to know is that I think there's really no going back now. It's not a matter of just, you know, even if the veto had been overturned, that wouldn't have brought about divestment. It would simply have opened another chapter in the struggle. Maybe that chapter is still a little bit further down the road than we wanted, but it's coming. The important point about BDS, it functions on a number of levels. Yes, one is an economic level, that divestment from Israel, consumer boycotts of Israeli products and so on, may hurt Israel economically. But actually, that impact is likely to be fairly small, realistically. That's not how apartheid regimes are brought to their feet. It's not simply a matter of hitting them in the wallet, although we should do that as much as possible and as much as our ability allows. It is about creating as Israeli leaders have recognized, about legitimacy. And why this is winnable now, I think, is because of a quite profound cultural change that is going on, a cultural and political change that is going on in this country. If you think back a few years ago, or historically over the past few decades, the bulk of support for Israel came from what are called in this country liberals and even progressives. You remember we used to have this problem where the progressive movement wouldn't talk about Palestine. And in fact, many people were supportive of Israel. That has actually shifted now. And you see that there are still very few mainstream liberals who are still willing to stand up and speak strongly in favor of Israel. There are still some, but they're quite few. I think the more noticeable thing is how many are remaining silent, how many are not standing up in defense of Israel. And I think gradually you'll start to see a shift where people are actually prepared to stand up more and more and be critical of Israel. The important shift, I think, is you look at where Israel's constituency in this country has moved. And it has moved primarily to the far right, to the racist right, to the white supremacist right, and to the Islamophobic right. What you find more and more is that the pro-Israel base in this country is a racist base, and more an openly racist base. What you find also is that supporters of Israel are unable to come up with arguments, effective arguments in support of Zionism. And they have to resort more and more to demonization and denigration of Arabs and Muslims and Palestinians. To say, we need Israel because they're savages. We need Israel to defend humanity and civilization against those crazy Muslims. We need Israel because it's like us and not like those dark, scary people. Of course, I'm simplifying. But actually, if you break it down, this is where most of the pro-Israel arguments lie these days. The other strategy which Israel is using, those who are smart enough to know that this isn't a winning strategy in the long term, try to change the subject. They try to do what we call greenwashing of Israel, to say Israel is this wonderful haven of technology and solar panels and planting trees. And don't worry about all that stuff in Gaza. Look at all the nice things Israel does. And there isn't a green rug big enough to sweep Gaza and the war crimes and the growing piles of bodies under. So what it means is if you put yourself, it's a good game to play. I did this last year when I went to Canada to speak to the student organizers there. We did a role-playing game. I said, let's pretend we're the Israeli cabinet. And we're meeting with the heads of the major Zionist organizations in the United States. What's our strategy? Let's try to come up with a winning strategy. And we couldn't. There is no way out of this dead end, except to rely more and more on brute force, on intimidation, on accusing people of anti-Semitism, on all these strategies that we see being fully deployed today. But what UC Berkeley showed us is that the first time it came up for a vote, there was a big majority in favor of divestment. And then the Zionists tried all their tricks, and the second time it came up for a vote, there was a big majority for divestment. And then the third time it came up for a vote, after all the intimidation and all the pressure, there was a big majority for divestment. It didn't disappear. Yes, they didn't overturn the veto. This is a democracy. In the United States, one vote outweighs the majority. That's democracy. You have to accept it. We have something similar in Palestine nowadays. Anyway, but the point here, I'm close to the end of my time, so I want to bring it back to South Africa. When I was in South Africa, I spoke to a lot of students, and something surprised me about that, because when I go to universities in this country, and we talk a lot about South Africa, it gives us hope, it gives us strategies, it gives us points of comparison, and I have to remind myself that the young people who are in university today were not born, or they were just being born around the time of the struggle against apartheid. They don't have their own memory of it, so they have to learn about it. And those of us who are old enough to remember it have a responsibility to talk about it as well. Well, it's exactly the same in South Africa. There's now an entire generation of young people with no memory of the struggle against apartheid. And so what I told them, I said, you have to understand something. For you growing up here, South Africa is just another country among all the others. You don't realize that South Africa holds a special place in the consciousness and conscience of the world. So, you know, this is why when Eugene Terblanche was killed, it was world news. This is why when Julius Malema was singing Kill the Boer and there was a controversy around it, it was world news. Because the world is watching to see if South Africa can live up to the promise that of the Freedom Charter and of the liberation struggle. And so for my generation, South Africa is much more than a country. It's a vision and it's an idea. And it's something where we really need you to renew that vision and to succeed and to complete the struggle. But what is so inspiring is that Palestine today has become the South Africa for this generation. And when you see on the college campuses this cultural shift I'm talking about, that the pro-Palestinian rights groups are really a rainbow coalition. That they don't just draw Palestinian students and Arab students and Muslim students. They draw students of every background, including many Jewish students, and sometimes primarily Jewish students, which shows the power of this universal idea that lies behind the struggle for freedom in Palestine. And when you look at the Zionist groups, who do they attract? They attract the segments I talked about. Yes, there is a minority of committed Zionists that will always be there, but increasingly they attract unsavory elements and people who cannot defend or do not put forward a universal view of humanity, one that really respects and believes in and seeks to advance the dignity and equality of all human beings. So that really is our strength. When you go to the Apartheid Museum and you see the artifacts of the struggle, the most terrifying weapons are the nooses. You see the nooses that they hanged people in apartheid South Africa. They are the armored vehicles that I saw. When I climbed into one, I hit my head on the steel roof and I cut myself here. I still have a little bit of the scar. So I carry the feeling of that hard steel that many Palestinians experience every day. But those actually turned out to be the weakest of all the weapons. The strongest ones were the ideas, and those are the ones that we really have to carry forward through the BDS movement until we come back together as Al-Awda to celebrate and also to start designing that Museum of Zionism. Thank you very much.